Hello and welcome to the Hopkins Biotech Podcast, where we illuminate life science career opportunities outside of academia through the experiences of those who have been there before. For updates about upcoming guests, follow us on social media and visit us at hopkinsbiotechpodcast.com to check out our full catalog of episodes. Today, we're bringing back the Boston Biotech series, produced in collaboration with the Professional Development and Career Office at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. In this series, we talk with individuals who work in the Boston Biotech ecosystem. If you are a Johns Hopkins student, we encourage you to join the Boston Biotech community on the OneHop platform to connect with JHU alumni who work in Boston. You can find the link on our website at hopkinsbiotechpodcast.com or in the show notes. My name is Joe Varelli. Our guest today is Dr. Adam Jenkins. Adam is the Regional Site Director for the Massachusetts sites of BioLabs. BioLabs is an international membership-based network of shared lab and office facilities located in key biotech innovation clusters. Since 2009, over 230 companies have launched from BioLabs facilities, and those member companies have collectively raised more than $1 billion in private financings. With a growing number of sites across the globe, BioLabs is enabling company formation and promoting the biotech revolution. Prior to joining BioLabs in 2022, Adam worked at Biogen for 7 years in various data science roles and eventually held the title of Associate Director of Corporate Strategy and Partnerships for Insights and Analytics. Adam holds a PhD in genomics from Boston College. Adam, thanks for joining us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So I think we want to get started with a bit more about you, and I think you have a really interesting career path, and obviously your position at BioLabs is really the subject of today's interview. Before we start talking about what BioLabs is and what they do, tell us a little bit about your path from PhD to Biogen to eventually leading these regional sites within BioLabs.
Sure. So I'll say that my path is probably was unique at the time, but it's becoming less and less unique as more opportunities open up outside academia. So when I was at Boston College, I'll say long story short, I knew I didn't want to go in academia. So back in 2015, when I was finishing on my PhD, had garnered a lot of skills around programming, genomics, big data analysis. And this was really when kind of the application of in silico work outside of academia was really starting to catch hold. The field of data science, I think, had just been coined maybe a year before that. So the prospects of getting a job outside of academia while still using all the knowledge that I had was becoming more and more evident. So I actually took a fellowship during my last year in my PhD with Insight Data Science Fellowship in New York City, which was a 4-month kind of intense incubator style learning experience where you're working with a lot of the usually it's technology-based companies, so things like Spotify, Google's, Apple's, companies of that realm to see how you can utilize your skills in different fashions. Doing that, I learned that I wanted to stay in biology or biotech, and so I ended up working at Biogen. They had just started a group called I believe it was called Digital Health and Data Sciences, and the remit of the group was more or less figure out how we can use all this data that we have to further the company. So it was more or less I don't want to say a free-for-all, but it was a very open-ended career to start, where it was, you know, just really look for value propositions across the company that we could utilize. So I got to work on everything from commercial analytics and predicting patient churn, working with data from 23andMe, working on wearables for some of our early R&D programs. So got a really large swath of experience very, very quickly, and ended up really, really liking the business side. So I found that the untapped market for utilizing this type of knowledge base, everything that I'd learned during my PhD, all the problem solving, the programming, could really be applied in the commercial portion of the company, and really gain back both ROI and just interest on my side as well for the company. So I became the data science lead for the commercial medical side of Biogen. With that, I had a team of data scientists underneath me, optimized globally how our field force worked, you know, which physicians we talked to, which patients we needed to talk to when, how often. Worked a lot, like I said, internationally. So with companies or with countries like France, Canada, the UK, a lot of the EU, Asia Pacific countries. Again, just really making the company as strategically optimized as possible. That quickly led into a role of how do we optimize our own portfolio. What's hard to think about often, especially when you're a PhD, is that large companies are thinking 15, 20, 25, 30 years down the line when you're not going to be there and you're not going to see the fruits of your labor. So working with them on the portfolio management side to say, 20 years from now, what assets do we need to buy or do we need to have coming to market? Where do we need to invest today? Which companies do we need to purchase from an M&A perspective? And from that, I learned that I really liked working with small biotechs. A lot of planning for the future is kind of looking at the landscape and looking at the science that's being made and which companies will be ripe for investment, either in the near term or the short term. And I found that I was jealous of one, how quickly they moved and how they were able to kind of make their own way. When biolabs came on my radar as a potential next step for my own career, I kind of jumped at the opportunity. And last year I took the dive in and took over as the site lead for all of our Massachusetts sites.
Yeah, and biolabs is a pretty lean operation in terms of how many people are at the site. I'll say that I had the great opportunity through the Boston BioTrek with the Professional Development and Career Office to go visit biolabs. You know, I'll give you the chance to explain what biolabs is and, you know, maybe what's unique about your sites in Massachusetts, but it's a pretty lean operation. So I imagine that was kind of a very unique opportunity. And I'm interested to find out more about how you approached that or if you were approached by someone and how that got on your radar.
Yeah, so I was not approached by it. I actually found it by chance. You know, talking to some other founders who were going through who were in the biolabs ecosystem and just the Boston Cambridge biotech ecosystem in general. I had always known about biolabs just because they've been here, like you said, since 2009. So I just learned about the role circumstantially, and kind of went through and applied, long process. As you said, we are quite lean and it's, one of the reasons why is that it's a very specific type of person, who can help foster, the many, founders, entrepreneurs, startup companies. It's not that you're just doing the same thing every day. So it's a very unique person who has to be able to, one, roll with the punches, things are going to be changing, the job's going to be different every single day, and not get overwhelmed. So when you say we're lean, we are lean for a reason because we only select, you know, certain people to be in the roles. If we were to be kind of a much larger organization, we could not be as lean and change as much as the ecosystem needs. Every year, the science progresses and we need to be able to change to support the entrepreneurs. So having a small support system for them makes that as easy as possible.
Yeah. And getting into biolabs, so it's a shared lab space with office facilities as well. And it's not really an incubator and it's not really an accelerator. It's its own thing. I want you to kind of describe in your own words what biolabs is and what types of, you know, work you facilitate there.
Yeah. So like you said, we don't take any equity in our companies. So, you know, it's not an incubator in that sense. At its core, we do provide shared lab space for all of the companies. That's kind of the core offering. You know, that's nothing special in terms of, you know, especially in Boston, Cambridge, you know, there's many of them. What we really accelerate as is empowering those entrepreneurs to accelerate the science worldwide. So that's everything from facilitating those industry relationships. So like you said, I came from Biogen, but we work with the Sanofis, the Bayers of the world all the time, just so that they know where the investment opportunities are and we can often make those introductions. We have a lot of partnerships with the local area. So in Boston, for instance, we are partnered with Tufts University. In New York, where we work with Langone Center. So we work a lot with the academic partners of the world. So we can do that work as well. But then as well, we are also very, very tied to the funding sources as well. So we know most of the VCs, the private equity firms, those investors who are looking for the kind of the newest and brightest entrepreneurs to invest in. So like you said, we've, you know, currently in Boston, we have upwards of 60 entrepreneurs who are starting their companies in our three spaces. Many of them are very, very intelligent scientists, know exactly what they're doing at the bench, but most of them have never started a company before. So navigating how to create funding, how to set up contracts, how to do all of the back end work that comes with owning your own company is something they've never done before. So we provide support on all those levels. So not only do they not have to worry about all that, but they have a support structure behind them so that they can accelerate their science and not ever be hampered based on non-scientific hindrances. So they should never have to think about lab operations. They should never have to think about, you know, shipping and handling, things like that, basic things that you never have to think about, so that they can just worry about the science and move forward as fast as possible or at whatever pace they think is necessary to meet that next milestone.
Yeah, and it's a membership-based organization. And I think one of the really cool things that I learned about BioLabs is that you could rent even a single bench space, right? You could have a single track of bench space to be able to start a company or work on whatever you would like to work on. So tell me about that. Tell me about the range of size of company, you know, maybe number of people involved and if there are any like single operators. And how BioLabs model in particular enables it to facilitate those types of company foundings.
Yeah. So we have a lot of single operators. We have a lot of, you know, like I said, phenomenal scientists who said, I have a great idea. I have seed funding, whether it be a friends and family round or from a single investor, and they need to make, you know, POC data to make their, you know, Series A or seed round, whatever their their next milestone might be. So the range of companies can, like I said, either span from a single bench all the way up to our largest company right now is 23 people actually on site at any one given time. That being said, a lot of companies end up keeping an R&D space in our area as they expand because there is a lot of value from them in both a talent pool. Another nice thing is because you're in a space with 30 other companies, there's a lot of crosstalk between the companies in terms of where they could collaborate. We've had companies partner multiple times to figure out how their two sciences can work together. But like I said, the goal is for them to grow. So it is very, very simple to start with one bench. You get your next funding round. The next day they could say, we need five more benches. We can provide that, assuming that the site isn't 100% full, which we try to never make happen. So the goal is growth for everyone, getting them to the next size. And we've had, like you mentioned before, enough success in terms of funding, you know, over the last decade and a half. Companies IPOing, companies being bought out by major players in the biotech and the pharma space, where we know how it's done and we can really coach those companies that are the single bench and, you know, maybe two or three employees to make that next step in their journey.
Can you tell us about some of those individual success stories and it maybe showcase why BioLabs was able to help them?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, we've had multiple companies start with, you know, just a couple employees, you know, less than $1 million in funding and really make a dent. So if we think of something, you know, which has impacted, you know, my life or, you know, I was involved with, Nightstar Therapeutics was in BioLabs prior to 2019 when Biogen purchased them for about $850 million. So they have been doing a lot of their US-based research at our site. As well, two companies that come to mind, Calvista and Akouos, They both, so Akouos specifically entered BioLabs in 2017 with only 4 employees. And then by 2020, 3 years later, they IPO'd and got about $215 million in public offering. So we've seen it done. I think that what's unique about BioLabs is because we are so lean and able to support any change that you might need, that many of our other competitors can't do that. Because most of us are founders and we've seen founders and we've worked with them before, the ability to see difficulties coming from, you know, a year out and having the ability to talk to those companies and being close to them. If you want to think of us as kind of an advisor, an unofficial advisor for most of the companies, we make that happen as much as possible. But, you know, in the Boston area specifically, you know, off the top of my head, I can say that we've had about over the last 5 years, I think we've had $500 million in total investments across our companies, 3 IPOs. We've seen most success stories over the last couple of years.
Yeah, and for the founders, you're not just buying into lab space and office facilities. You're really, like you said, buying into the culture, buying into connections, and the ability to kind of foster a collaborative environment with these other companies as well as your sponsor partners and VCs. For BioLabs, tell me about the business model. You know, why does it make sense for BioLabs? And of course, you mentioned that you don't take equity, so clearly there's another structure that's at play here that allows you to be successful.
Yeah, so we are a fee for service. So like you said, companies do come and they rent benches. We do have some small private labs as well at all of our sites. So we, you know, the success of the companies and of the residents that are at our sites means success for us. When they grow and they need more space and they need to rent out more benches, that is success for us as well. So we want them to be successful. If we were to take equity, that muddies the waters a little bit more. You know, because we don't want to play favorites. We want to make sure that everyone has an equitable and is on a fair playing field with us to get all the resources that we provide. We don't necessarily want to prioritize one or the other. So that's the main way that we work. In terms of partnerships, we do manage sites as well. So if we look at just the pure numbers, so we do have 15 sites internationally, 11 in the U.S., 2 more in Paris, 1 in Germany, and a partnered site in Japan. So we are aggressively expanding outside the U.S. as well. I think that over the last 2 or 3 years, we've opened up 5 new sites. So we are constantly looking for those hubs of biotech and innovation where we can enter and either help create that community or take that community to the next level of where we think that it could go, whether it be funding or they just need a startup incubator like ourselves to really get those companies flowing. We're always looking to find that next opportunity, whether it's a good realty deal, a good partnership, a good next step for the company, while still being cognizant of founders come first. You know, we need to make sure that if it's not for the good of the residents and of the founders, and they're, you know, it's not, we probably won't make that deal or that next step.
For you, I like the way you describe it, kind of entering into communities and existing biotech hubs and facilitating company founding. Is there kind of a goal that you would have for serving underserved biotech communities? And can you think of an example where BioLabs is trying to do that and kind of build from the ground up?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that our European centers are kind of a good illustration of that. Most of the time when we go into a community that doesn't have a thriving startup space, if we want to call that a startup ecosystem, it's not because that there is a lack of people who want to make their own companies. It might be that the ecosystem is much more geared towards academia and companies are kind of sit in those academic labs for much longer than normal. And it goes to the tech transfer office and, you know, you kind of get stuck in that postdoc wheel of death where you're stuck there for an indefinite amount of time and see where you can go. So a lot of times it's how can we partner and change the ecosystem so that those people who want to start their own companies are supported and know how. So in Europe, a lot of companies stick with academia. Academics is kind of the gold standard, and people vouch for who they are based on which academic university or college they're a part of. We want to change that a little bit to say, you know, if you want to start your own thing, it is completely viable to do that. And you don't have to stay within that academic structure. You can really go out and start it on your own. So we do that a fair amount. And like I said, a lot of our partners are academic facilities like Tufts University or NYU, because they understand the worth of having that those companies spin off and having that road to spin off companies that's not just purely through an academic lab. So we're always looking to find areas where we can really make an impact and not just be another kind of name or an opportunity. We really want to be able to mold that ecosystem and that community into something that we've seen as successful.
I always find it interesting that biotech, it makes sense that it occurs in these hubs that are often centered around, you know, great academic institutions like that of Boston. And this is really the Boston Biotech series. So I want to have a broader discussion about Boston biotech and the ecosystem in general. And you've been there for quite a while. And I'm wondering what you think in particular makes the Boston biotech ecosystem really thrive. And, you know, where do you see that growth in the future? I am from Boston, and every time I go back, there's more lab space being built in places where I never expected new lab space to be built. And so I always think that, well, eventually it's going to top out and there's, you know, going to be nowhere else to build, but they keep expanding outside of Boston. And even within Boston, most new construction projects are slated for at least in part some lab space. So what keeps fueling this growth in your opinion?
Yeah. So I think that recently, so I'll say at its core, the sheer density of universities. Of course, we have the Harvard, MITs, you know, the Boston universities. We have a very, very strong core of academic excellence that just perpetuates into every facet of science. So there's no, lack of ability to find good talent, find good ideas. There's just a lot of people here that are very intelligent and can take that next step. With that comes a lot of risk taking as well. You know, there are a lot of, I'll say, you know, there's a lot of lab space being built. There needs to be a lot of risk takers to try and take on that lab space, the mortgage or the fees that come along with that. So it's the combination of very intelligent people with some very non-risk averse people to make that work. And I will say with everything that's happened, you know, recently with SVB and the banking system, we're seeing a lot more companies get a little smarter with their cash. So, you know, over the last couple of years in the US, Boston holds between 25 and 40% of all biotech investments that happen. So if you think of all the money coming in that's invested in biotechs across the US, for that amount of money to come into a single city or greater city area, is a lot of money. So with that comes, you know, everything, every single support structure that comes with that cash, whether it be labs, startups, law firms, everything that comes within this. But now that banking is kind of at the forefront, everyone's starting to say, okay, if I have $50 million in my bank account, is it just going to sit there? Should I utilize it more efficiently and go to North Texas? Should we go to another site that's a little cheaper that, you know, we can still get the same type of operational efficiency, things like that. So I will say it is changing, but I'll say it's changing for the better because free cash isn't always the best thing for there to be.
I really like those insights, but digging in a little bit further, I think that's sort of where a lot of people land on Boston is the coalescence of great academic institutions, financing, a wealth of smart individuals. Could you build something de novo in a part of the country where those things don't exist, but foster a great biotech ecosystem? And And I guess, like, how do organizations like biolabs help? I think we're kind of asking this question multiple ways, but I'm really interested in kind of like how a new biotech hub might be seeded in the absence of some of those factors that we mentioned.
Yeah, it takes a lot to bring a true ecosystem to fruition. And it's not just the private sector. It takes a lot of government involvement, a lot of investment from third parties, whether it be local level governments, whether it be nonprofits. It takes a long time for a city like Boston to spring up somewhere else. So, you know, San Diego is probably the next closest that there is. But if you were to spring up in, you know, in a different city, it's going to take, you know, 10 years, I would say, just for kind of the first fruits of your labor to start to come through, because there is so much that goes into building a biotech. If you think of something as simple as how am I going to get rid of my biomedical waste? If you don't have that support system in the city, that's going to take you years to figure out, and you're going to have to go through a million different hoops with the government to make that work. So the nice thing, again, being in Boston, is that we've gone through all that, and they've gone through the growing pains in this area, that we have everything pretty much at our fingertips to build a company very, very quickly. Biolabs in general has been assessing this. So if you think we just build a site in North Texas, in just above Dallas, not a traditional biotech hub, but we know that there's a lot of opportunity there for companies who want to be there, don't want to be on either coast, want to be in Texas, want to be in Dallas. So we built a site there to foster that ecosystem. It's a lot of heavy lifting to get a new ecosystem up and running, for sure.
Yeah, I'm thinking too about Chicago. It was selected as the site for the new Chan Zuckerberg BioHub.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we at JHU are hoping that Baltimore can be the next great biotech epicenter on the East Coast. So switching to more of a careers-focused question, what's the advantage for new grads moving to Boston? Obviously, you did your graduate work in Boston, so you didn't have to go too far. But for our listeners, either in Baltimore or elsewhere across the country, who are deciding whether they want to kind of stay put or move to a big hub like Boston, what's the advantage there for them?
Number of opportunities. That's number one. I mean, you can go into, you'll see a lot of technical graduates going into non-scientific fields. So whether it be banking, whether it be in finance, anything that has any type of analytical skill set needs, technology, you know, all those type of things that can be utilized are really utilized to their fullest here. Everyone knows that smart people can be utilized for a lot of different things rather than just something that they're trained in. And I think that a lot of graduates forget that if you have your PhD in the science, you've done a lot of troubleshooting, you've done a lot of storytelling, you've done a lot of things that aren't necessarily top of mind when you think about your PhD. You think, hey, I just did my thesis and I put together this book that's 200 pages and it's going to be read by not that many people, but there are a lot of things behind that in terms of skills. Boston's very good at utilizing those skills that you don't think about in other industries.
Certainly. And, you know, I think the weather keeps some people away, but
you learn to love it.
For me, I like it. Yeah. Okay. Let's do something a little bit more fun. And I really appreciate your data science background. So I think I want to get some of your opinions on maybe the future of data science. You're not that far removed from your roles at Biogen. You know, really interesting hearing you talking about it from the perspective of someone who was there sort of as data science was becoming its own field. And of course, now it's so ingrained in every aspect of everything we do in biotech and healthcare. What are your predictions for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years? How is data science and maybe to get buzzwordy, but AI and machine learning and big data, how are all those things being integrated into biotech and healthcare now? And what are you excited about for the future of data science and biotech?
Yeah, I think that the last 5-10 years have been a lot of learnings, a lot of testing things out that we weren't sure of whether it was going to work, whether the applications were going to be resulting in anything that would be of monetary use for the companies, things like that. So I think that over the next 5-10 years, two things are going to happen. I think the number of companies that purely work in AI or big data are going to decrease. I think that because money isn't free anymore and because there are a lot of companies have been burned, a lot of promises haven't been kept by a lot of data science focused companies, by a lot of consultants, things like that, there's a lot more skepticism around what is the actual ROI of this project going to be. I think that the field as a whole is going to do a lot in terms of decreasing the length of time from, it's not benchtop to bedside anymore. It's, computer to bedside. I think that the length of time is going to decrease by a lot. So that drug discovery, the hit discovery, the optimization of everything is going to go a long way in terms of finding new drugs and unique drugs that we've never thought about. That are predicted online. I think that those ones are going to go a long way. And it's just a matter of there's a lot of support from a government standpoint that has to change. So if you think about, how the FDA approves drugs that have never been seen before that are going to have to, be assessed in different ways because they have different formulations and things like that. I think that there's going to be a lot of change from the FDA standpoint that's going to happen in the next 5, 10, 15 years.
I like the idea of shortening development timelines. I definitely agree with that. What about from the standpoint of genomics? I think, since your time in grad school, there's also been a burgeoning field of new sequencing technologies and understanding insights into both human genomics and other organisms like pathogens. And How do those two things go hand in hand? Obviously, data analytics plays a big role in our understanding of genomics. So what do you see in the future of genomics and sequencing technology and in the role of data science there?
Yeah, I think it's a difficult question because every time that I think we get a new technology, we think that this is going to solve the questions that we've been wondering. When we sequenced the genome, we thought that all diseases, we're going to be able to figure it out. Once we finally got the full genome, we realized there were, the epigenome, the proteome, there's a never ending, tortoiseshell of omes that we're looking at. So I think that we'll definitely get better resolution of the potential issues that could cause, but I still think that the biological interplay still has to be figured out. I think that the story still isn't as clear as we thought it once was. So, for instance, we thought we were going to solve, diabetes, heart disease, these things that we thought that were going to end up being monogenic diseases, which, are in retrospective, like, of course they're polygenic. Of course it's not as simple as we thought it once was, but it's not that we don't know what's in play. It's that we can't tease out the story. So what I'm hoping is that, the new genetics platforms come out, as Oxford Nanopore is, we're able to do things like that. I think that it's going to enable a lot more, non-R01 level science to be made that could really have an impact. So, lower level universities and things like that, that historically haven't been able to have the firepower to do the research that they would want just because of their support structure. Now we'll be able to do a lot of the science and we'll open up discoveries to people who would never have had the opportunity beforehand. So I think that that's where the real opportunity lies and where I hope that genomics and proteomics and every field kind of starts to go to enable non-traditional scientists to have a go at it.
Right. Yeah. I think the cost consideration, it's the cost per gigabyte of sequence data keeps going down. So I hope that it enables, smaller universities or less well-funded early career researchers to have a greater impact. So I appreciate those insights.
Or even internationally, a lot of the things is, now if you think of, the Human Genome Consortium and all these different things that are no longer just, three or four universities, but 10, 20, 30 international universities where everyone can put all their brain power together. I think that that's also enabled by all the technologies just, taking a leap forward recently.
Yeah. Well, Adam, thank you so much for coming on to talk to us about your career in data science and now facilitating company creation at BioLabs. And I really had the pleasure to visit BioLabs and see all of the incredible work that you're doing, and hoping for continued expansion and maybe a BioLabs site in Baltimore.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, Adam.
All right. Thanks, Shep.
Thank you for joining us. Don't forget to follow Hopkins Biotech Podcast on social media at Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, or Twitter for updates about upcoming guests. And visit us at hopkinsbiotechpodcast.com to check out our full catalog of episodes. I'm Joe Varielli. Thank you for listening.